Chapter 54. A new lodger, the long vacation saunters on towards term time like an idle river very leisurely strolling down a flat country to the sea. Mr. Guppy saunters along with it congenially. He has blunted the blade of his penknife, and broken the point off by sticking that instrument into his desk in every direction. Not that he bears the desk any ill will, but he must do something, and it must be something of an unexciting nature, which will lay neither his physical nor his intellectual energies under too heavy contribution. He finds that nothing agrees with him so well as to make little gyrations on one leg of his stool, and stab his desk, and gape. Kenge and Carboy are out of town, and the article clerk has taken out a shooting license, and gone down to his father's, and Mr. Guppy's two fellow stipendiaries are away on leave. Mr. Guppy and Mr. Richard Carstone divide the dignity of the office. But Mr. Carstone is for the time being established in Kenge's room, whereat Mr. Guppy chafes so exceedingly that he with biting sarcasm informs his mother, in the confidential moments, when he sucks with her off a lobster and lettuce in the Old Street Road, that he is afraid the office is hardly good enough for swells, and that if he had known there was a swell coming, he would have got it painted. Mr. Guppy suspects everybody who enters on the occupation of a stool in Kenge and Carboy's office of entertaining, as a matter of course, sinister designs upon him. He is clear that every such person wants to depose him. If he be ever asked how, why, when, or wherefore, he shuts up one eye and shakes his head. On the strength of these profound views, he in the most ingenious manner takes infinite pains to counterplot when there is no plot, and plays the deepest games of chess without any adversary. It is a source of much gratification to Mr. Guppy, therefore, to find the newcomer constantly poring over the papers in Jarndyce and Jarndyce, for he well knows that nothing but confusion and failure can come of that. His satisfaction communicates itself to a third saunterer through the long vacation in Kenge and Carboy's office, to wit, young Smallweed. Whether young Smallweed, metaphorically called Small, and Eek Chickweed, as it were jocularly to express a fledgling, was ever a boy is much doubted in Lincoln's Inn. He is now something under 15, and an old limb of the law. He is facetiously understood to entertain a passion for a lady at a cigar shop in the neighborhood of Chancery Lane and for her sake, to have broken off a contract with another lady, to whom he had been engaged some years. He is a town-made article, of small stature and weazen features, but may be perceived from a considerable distance by means of his very tall hat. To become a Guppy is the object of his ambition. He dresses at that gentleman by whom he is patronized, talks at him, walks at him, founds himself entirely on him. He is honored with Mr. Guppy's particular confidence and occasionally advises him, from the deep wells of his experience, on difficult points in private life. Mr. Guppy has been lolling out of window all the morning, after trying all the stools in succession and finding none of them easy, and after several times putting his head into the iron safe with a notion of cooling it. Mr. Smallweed has been twice dispatched for effervescent drinks, and has twice mixed them in the two official tumblers, and stirred them up with the ruler. Mr. Guppy propounds for Mr. Smallweed's consideration the paradox that the more you drink the thirstier you are, and reclines his head upon the windowsill in a state of hopeless languor. While thus looking out into the shade of Old Square, Lincoln's Inn, surveying the intolerable bricks and mortar, Mr. Guppy becomes conscious of a manly whisker emerging from the cloistered walk below, and turning itself up in the direction of his face. At the same time, a low whistle is wafted through the inn and a suppressed voice cries, "Hip! Guppy! Why, you don't mean it!" says Mr. Guppy, aroused. "Small! Here's Jobling!" Small's head looks out of window too, and nods to Jobling. "Where have you sprung up from?" inquires Mr. Guppy. "From the market gardens down by Deptford. I can't stand it any longer. I must enlist. I say, I wish you'd lend me half a crown. upon my soul, I'm hungry. Joblin looks hungry, and also has the appearance of having run to seed in the market gardens down by Deptford. I say, just throw out half a crown, if you have got one to spare. I want to get some dinner. Will you come and dine with me? Says Mr. Guppy, throwing out the coin, which Mr. Joblin catches neatly. How long should I have to hold out? Says Joblin. Not half an hour. I am only waiting here till the enemy goes, returns Mr. Guppy, butting inward with his head. What enemy? A new one. Going to be articled. Will you wait? Can you give a fellow anything to read in the meantime? Says Mr. Joblin. Smallweed suggests the law list. But Mr. Joblin declares with much earnestness that he can't stand it. You shall have the paper, says Mr. Guppy. He shall bring it down. But you had better not be seen about here. Sit on our staircase and read. It's a quiet place. Joblin nods intelligence and acquiescence. The sagacious Smallweed supplies him with the newspaper, and occasionally drops his eye upon him from the landing as a precaution against his becoming disgusted with waiting and making an untimely departure. At last the enemy retreats, and then Smallweed fetches Mr. Joblin up. Well, and how are you? Says Mr. Guppy, shaking hands with him. So, how are you? Mr. Guppy replying that he is not much to boast of, Mr. Joblin ventures on the question, how is she? This Mr. Guppy resents as a liberty, retorting, Joblin, there are chords in the human mind. Joblin begs pardon. Any subject but that, says Mr. Guppy with a gloomy enjoyment of his injury. For there are courts, Joblin, Mr. Joblin begs pardon again. During this short colloquy, the act of Smallweed, who is of the dinner party, has written in legal characters on a slip of paper, return immediately. This notification to all whom it may concern, he inserts in the letterbox, and then putting on the tall hat at the angle of inclination at which Mr. Guppy wears his, informs his patron that they may now make themselves scarce. Accordingly they betake themselves to a neighboring dining house, of the class known among its frequenters by the denomination Slap Bang, where the waitress, a bouncing young female of 40, is supposed to have made some impression on the susceptible Smallweed, of whom it may be remarked that he is a weird changeling to whom ears are nothing. He stands precociously possessed of centuries of owlish wisdom. If he ever lay in a cradle, it seems as if he must have lain there in a tailcoat. He has an old eye, has Smallweed, and he drinks and smokes in a monkeyish way, and his neck is stiff in his collar, and he is never to be taken in, and he knows all about it, whatever it is. In short, in his bringing up he has been so nursed by law and equity that he has become a kind of fossil imp, to account for whose terrestrial existence it is reported at the public offices that his father was John Doe, and his mother the only female member of the Roe family, also that his first long clothes were made from a blue bag. Into the dining house, unaffected by the seductive show in the window of artificially whitened cauliflowers and poultry, verdant baskets of peas, coolly blooming cucumbers, and joints ready for the spit, Mr. Smallweed leads the way. They know him there and defer to him. He has his favorite box, he bespeaks all the papers, he is down upon bald patriarchs, who keep them more than 10 minutes afterwards. It is of no use trying him with anything less than a full-sized bread or proposing to him any joint in cut, unless it is in the very best cut. In the matter of gravy he is adamant. Conscious of his elfin power and submitting to his dread experience, Mr. Guppy consults him in the choice of that day's banquet, turning an appealing look towards him as the waitress repeats the catalogue of viands and saying, "What do you take, chick?" Chick, out of the profundity of his artfulness, preferring veal and ham and French beans, and don't you forget the stuffing. Polly, with an unearthly cock of his venerable eye, Mr. Guppy and Mr. Joblin give the like order. 3 pint pots of half and half are superadded. Quickly the waitress returns bearing what is apparently a model of the Tower of Babel, but what is really a pile of plates and flat tin dish covers. Mr. Smallweed, approving of what is set before him, conveys intelligent benignity into his ancient eye and winks upon her. Then, amid a constant coming in, and going out, and running about, and a clatter of crockery, and a rumbling up and down of the machine which brings the nice cuts from the kitchen, and a shrill crying for more nice cuts down the speaking pipe, and a shrill reckoning of the cost of nice cuts that have been disposed of, and a general flush and steam of hot joints, cut and uncut, and a considerably heated atmosphere in which the soiled knives and tablecloths seem to break out spontaneously into eruptions of grease and blotches of beer, the legal triumvirate appease their appetites. Mr. Jobling is buttoned up closer than mere adornment might require. His hat presents at the rims a peculiar appearance of a glistening nature, as if it had been a favorite snail promenade. The same phenomenon is visible on some parts of his coat, and particularly at the seams. He has the faded appearance of a gentleman in embarrassed circumstances. Even his light whiskers droop with something of a shabby air. His appetite is so vigorous that it suggests spare living for some little time back. He makes such a speedy end of his plate of veal and ham, bringing it to a close, while his companions are yet midway in theirs, that Mr. Guppy proposes another. "Thank you, Guppy," says Mr. Jobling, "I really don't know, but what I will take another." Another being brought, he falls to with great goodwill. Mr. Guppy takes silent notice of him at intervals until he is halfway through his second plate, and stops to take an enjoying pull at his pint pot of half and half, also renewed, and stretches out his legs and rubs his hands. Beholding him in which glow of contentment, Mr. Guppy says, "You are a man again, Tony." "Well, not quite yet," says Mr. Jobling. "Say, just born. Will you take any other vegetables? Grass? Peas? Summer cabbage?" "Thank you, Guppy," says Mr. Jobling. "I really don't know, but what I will take summer cabbage." Order given, with the sarcastic addition from Mr. Smallweed of "without slugs, Polly," and cabbage produced. "I am growing up, Guppy," says Mr. Jobling, plying his knife and fork with a relishing steadiness. "Glad to hear it. In fact, I have just turned into my teens," says Mr. Jobling. He says no more until he has performed his task, which he achieves as Messrs. Guppy and Smallweed finish theirs, thus getting over the ground in excellent style and beating those two gentlemen easily by a veal and ham and a cabbage. "Now, Small," says Mr. Guppy, "what would you recommend about pastry?" "Marrow puddings," says Mr. Smallweed instantly. Aye, cries Mr. Jobling with an arch look. "You're there, are you?" "Thank you, Mr. Guppy, I don't know, but what I will take a marrow pudding." Three marrow puddings being produced, Mr. Jobling adds in a pleasant humor that he is coming of age fast. To he succeed, by command of Mr. Smallweed, three Cheshires, and to those three small rums. This apex of the entertainment happily reached, Mr. Jobling puts up his legs on the carpeted seat, having his own side of the box to himself, leans against the wall, and says, "I am grown up now, Guppy. I have arrived at maturity." "What do you think now," says Mr. Guppy, "about you don't mind Smallweed?" "Not the least in the word. I have the pleasure of drinking his good health." "Sir, to you," says Mr. Smallweed. "I was saying, what do you think now," pursues Mr. Guppy, "of enlisting?" "Why, what I may think after dinner," returns Mr. Jobling, "is one thing, my dear Guppy, and what I may think before dinner is another thing. Still, even after dinner, I ask myself the question, what am I to do? How am I to live? Ilfo manger, you know," says Mr. Jobling, pronouncing that word as if he meant a necessary fixture in an English stable. "Ilfo manger. That's the French saying, and mangering is as necessary to me as it is to a Frenchman. Or more so." Mr. Smallweed is decidedly of opinion, much more so. If any man had told me, pursues Jobling, even so lately as when you and I had the frisk down in Lincolnshire, Guppy, and drove over to see that house at Castle Wold, Mr. Smallweed corrects him, Chesney Wold. Chesney Wold. I thank my honorable friend for that cheer. If any man had told me then, that I should be as hard up at the present time as I literally find myself, I should have pitched into him, says Mr. Jobling, taking a little rum and water with an air of desperate resignation. I should have let fly at his head. Still, Tony, you were on the wrong side of the post then, remonstrates Mr. Guppy. You were talking about nothing else in the gig. Guppy, says Mr. Jobling, I will not deny it. I was on the wrong side of the post. But I trusted two things coming round. That very popular trust in flat things coming round. Not in their being beaten round, or worked round, but in their coming round. As though a lunatic should trust in the world's coming triangular. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.